Hey, well, welcome everyone. Welcome to the Sati Center's Buddhist Chaplaincy Speaker Series. And today we're delighted to welcome Grace Shearson. So a few words of introduction for Grace. So Grace is a Zen abbess, president of the Shogaku Zen Institute, and a clinical psychologist. She received her doctorate in clinical psychology at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, California. She's founded two practice centers and a retreat center under the Central Valley Zen Foundation. She's the author of two books, Naked in the Zendo and Zen Women Beyond Tea Ladies, Iron Maidens, and Macho Masters. Grace also edited Zen Bridge, the Zen Teachings of Kaido Fukushima, with Peter Shearson. She's published articles in Shambhala Sun, Buddha Dharma, and Tricycle magazines. And has also been anthologized in many Zen books, including the Book of Mu, Receiving the Marrow, and The Hidden Lamp, as well as in a book on spiritual training, The Arts of Contemplative Care. So welcome, Grace, and over to you.
Great. It's terrific to see your students. I assume these are all students who are on their way to serving. And I think this is one of the most important aspects of our work. We begin this work for various reasons. By work, I mean our meditation work. We begin it for various reasons. Maybe we're unhappy. Maybe we want to hang out with other spiritually minded people. But sooner or later, we recognize that our true work is helping other people. And it's very important that we see that, especially I've noticed in the communities we're in. There's a great deal of status, in terms of what color robes we wear and so on, and what positions we attain. And certainly, having climbed that ladder, I know it well. But the important thing is, how do we take care of our students? And so we need to have certain skills. We need to develop ourselves. And not just through the meditation, but really learn some skills. How to work with people who have addictions, how to work with couples, how to work with people who are depressed. What are the meditations that are better for people who are depressed? And these are all questions that came up for me as a psychologist. I had received this training, but I didn't understand how. My fellow Zen people were able to have conversations with people who were troubled without learning some skills. And in the book on chaplaincy, The Arts of Contemplative Care, where I am featured in an article with Lewis Richmond for having started the Shogaku priest's ongoing training. We talk about the evolution of Buddhism in the West. Now, I think there are kind of two tracks that we're on. One, it follows a little bit of spiritual materialism. I'm kind of a grouch. And the other is how we develop ourselves to help other people. How do we let down and set down the status seeking and our needs as teachers? To belong, to be praised, to be cared about, and really focus on how we prevent harm to students and how we help them. So, this is why we started the Shogaku Zen Institute, because when Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the school of Zen that I'm in, when he came to the US, he said, "Well, you people are not quite lay and you're not quite priests," because in Japan, where he had been trained, everyone trained in a very strict monastic way. And then most of the people, the priests, had a temple that they most likely either inherited from their fathers or their father-in-law. Or these temples were handed to them by the sect of Zen that they belong to, like the Soto Shu, which is the sect that I belong to mostly, although I've studied Rinzai Shu in Japan. So, but it's a very interesting thing because in Japan, being a priest is a profession. And my husband loves to tell the story of when we were in Tokyo on one visit, and he spoke to a man at a bar, and he said, he asked him what he did for work. He spoke English, and he asked him what he did for work. He said, well, I'm either going to follow in my father's business, or I'm going to have to start my own. So he said, well, what's your father's business? He said, my father is a Zen priest. And he said, what would you do on your own? And he said, I would start a porn site. So it's a very different world. And the other thing is that we noticed when we were in Japan, people don't have the same reverence. That's an interesting choice of words for their priests, for their reverence. They sometimes see them as bald-headed rascals. And we saw that by finding falling down drunk priests in full robes in the train stations. So in Japan, the projection of greatness and leadership and holiness on the priest isn't there. But there are priests, and for example, Suzuki Roshi's son, Hoitsu Roshi, is one of them, who are very well respected. And he's respected in part because he teaches at the training temple, Eheiji, and in part because he does so much work with the community, seeing prisoners, putting on bazaars and for raising money for children, and through his friends who are all potters. And so he's well respected there. His community respects him. He lives with his wife and family in the temple, and the temple will pass on to, this was Suzuki Roshi's home temple, will pass on to his son. So it's a very different model. And once you've seen that model in Japan, and particularly the military precision with which they carry out ceremonies, you recognize we will never be able to do that. So what can we do? And this is how we started our training institute. What can we do as priests? How do we live in harmony with our lives as parents and spouses and priests and helpers? And how do we do that with the training we have? Well, one of the things that struck us as we began to look at what Suzuki Roshi had said to us, you're neither lay nor priest, and I'm not sure what will happen, where this movement will go in the West, in the US. When we began to look at that, we recognized that the training that people were receiving in Zen centers is about how to continue the Zen center. Everybody gets a position. They learn how to ring the bells. They learn how to place people in the Zendo. They learn how to chant. And those are the positions that are created. For example, I'm thinking of San Francisco Zen Center, where people live for years and learn how to do the things that will continue the functioning of the temple. So they get jobs that train them. Now, this does happen in Japan, but it only happens during the time that people are in the monastery, and then they go back to their home temple, which is more like living at home with family. So when we looked at the training that people were receiving at the major Zen institutions, we didn't, and that I'm talking about the San Francisco Zen Center lineage, we didn't see that people were actually benefiting in that way, coming out of the Zen Center training with a skill that enabled them to use all those years of meditation and spiritual practice to help people, to work in the world. And when I spoke, I did a lot of interfaith work when I worked in the Central Valley. And the minister said, you know, you call yourself priests, but you don't have an MDiv. And we all have MDivs after 2 years in the seminary. So those ideas came together for me is one thing we could do to help Zen students is to make them recognizable to the public as spiritual leaders who could help them with their problems in life, whether they be marital, whether they be depression, what problems people would come to a priest to discuss. How could we help these students learn skills and get a job? Because one of our first graduates, and I think he's come to speak to you, came out of San Francisco Zen Center after many years of training, and people will often enter at a very young, idealistic age. And he came out after so many years, maybe 10 years, and there he was refinishing floors, which is a fine business, but it didn't make as much use as of his Zen training as we would like, because we do develop some capacity in meditation to feel the feelings of others and to remain calm and useful when we hear about those problems. And how we use that for work in the world was very important to us. So our first inkling of how we might work together came when we saw how the model had changed. In the beginning, everyone belonged, at least in the San Francisco Zen Center, belonged to the Zen Center, lived in apartments close to the Zen Center or owned by the Zen Center. And then gradually, as the years went on, we started our own small practice places, and we were out in the world with family and all the needs that one has out in the world. We weren't being fed and supported by a Zen Center. We were in our own homes and we had bills to pay. So, and we noticed something. Our practicing and including students in our lives did not pay the bills. Sometimes there were donations and sometimes not, but not enough to really count as employers and to pay for our insurance, health insurance, et cetera, all the things. So, having a profession that provided a living wage also was an important part of how we wanted to further the model that Suzuki Roshi had given us, not lay, not priest, what will we become? And we thought it would be suitable if people had a degree, they had an MDiv, and they had training, and they were able to get jobs working to help people, like our counterparts in Christian and Jewish traditions and so on. So we came together to talk about how we might do that. Most of us who came together at that time were in small practice places and figuring out ways, as a psychologist, I could earn a living, my husband could earn a living, but figuring out ways to finance sharing the Dharma. So there were a number of us, maybe 10 or 15 of us, who were in this situation. We had trained either at San Francisco Zen Center or Berkeley Zen Center, and had done the practice, which is going to meditation on a daily basis, learning the chants, going to lecture, doing the long retreats, and so on. And we all recognized the value of that training. But now we were in a different situation, and that was how do we take care of our work in the home and our community? And what do our students need in addition to learning how to chant, ring the bells, and relate to the altar, help people enter the Zendo without crossing and stepping on the lines of the tatami, which is a big deal sometimes in some Zen centers. Don't step on the cracks between the tatamis. So there's a lot of correction to do it just so in the Zen center. So now we're in a different situation. And I'm going to stop now in case you have some questions for me, and I'll drink some coffee.
Grace, I have a question. I wonder if this element of pastoral care that, I think we assume it's maybe taught in seminary to, say, a Christian and Jewish counterparts. And, maybe it depends on the seminary, but I've definitely heard horror stories of pastors coming into hospitals and really having no sense of how to navigate pastoral care. And I know in my Zen training, it wasn't really something that came up. I'm curious for you whether that element of pastoral care, did that come up in your training at all? Or is there something new that you were trying to bring in?
Well, it was something new. We wanted to establish a standard in Zen. And of course, we did follow as we began, and we established later on, established an MDiv program, but began offering courses. We did follow what important and upright seminaries were offering in terms of the classes. So we followed the model of the Christian seminary from Harvard Divinity School on to what it is that people should study in order to offer pastoral care. And so that was an important element for us. But what we noticed right away, and especially after my conversation in interfaith work with Christian ministers, is that we hadn't had that. We had, and also the history of Buddhism maybe wasn't quite as accurate, and it reminded me of a friend who went to Catholic school, and when she started university, she found out all the history she'd learned in her parochial school wasn't the same as what they were teaching in university. So we learn something different, or we offer something different about interfaith work and the history. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's kind of how you what you wanted to offer for the Shogaku Institute. But I'm curious in your own, because you have your training as a clinical psychologist and then you have your training through Zen. So I'm wondering what resources you are able to draw on. Obviously, you're looking at what the seminaries were doing, but did that element of pastoral care, because I've heard, for instance, Gil recently talk about, he went to a conference about chaplaincy in Japan, and apparently it's not that much of a thing. Some people are doing community work, but it's kind of a new idea. So this element of providing kind of direct pastoral care, maybe it's not so much in the Zen tradition, but I wonder if there's anything that you are able to draw on beyond this sense of kind of meditation, being present, having that sense of connection to people. Is there anything more concrete that you are able to draw on?
No, not in my Zen training. Although as I continued up the ladder of Zen positions, I was given the opportunity to offer what was called practice discussion. and to help people along. But as a psychologist, I knew where to go and where not to go in these conversations, but I really wondered about how other people coped because they didn't have that training. And it's interesting that you mentioned that about Japan, that chaplaincy is new. I know Joan Halifax is over there now talking about her program and teaching them maybe how to do her program. But in Europe as well, I study Spanish with a teacher in Madrid, and he had never really heard of chaplaincy. I mean, they have Catholic priests, period. And they do not have a pastoral care program there either. He was very interested in what we were doing. So, and it, describing it in Spanish was its own work, but that's another story. In any case, no, I don't think I got the training, although we did talk. There was one thing we did in both in psychology and in Zen training, and in psychology or counseling, it's called group soup, the group supervision where you talk about your cases. It's a little more delicate in the Zen community because we all knew who people were talking about. And, but we did try to talk about a little bit about the situations that arose and difficulties that we were having a little bit, but it was harder because of the issue of confidentiality. Everybody knew everybody. So it's a lot harder to talk about the cases and to talk about, well, what would you do here? So when we started the Shogaku Zen Institute, we had a lot of fun creating cases. And the most fun I had was when we created a case with a male teacher and a female student coming on to that teacher. And there seems to be something almost inevitable in the magnetism there of women being attracted to men in power. And there's something there. And it was really a great deal of fun to watch how uncomfortable our priests became when the women were flirting with them. And we would create very elaborate scenarios about, for example, oh, it's your birthday. Oh, I'd love to join you for your birthday, and keep ramping it up and watch the discomfort of the priest because he didn't know what to say. They hadn't yet been in that situation. And it seems to come, not for the priests in training, but for the priests who take a position in power in the community. So it was good to prepare them. And finally, I remember how happy I was to hear one of our young male priests answer and refer to his own feelings and say, I'm becoming uncomfortable with this conversation. And that was kind of a model that people could actually not be the perfect Zen person alone on the mountain, but actually a human being who was having feelings. So this kind of training, exposing people, because in the role plays, actually it's like acting, it is acting. In the role plays that we created, people would become emotionally stirred and take on the role and feel these feelings. So and that was a big part of how we trained people, was by creating these kinds of role plays and watching how people dealt with it. It was, we also created, you know, same sex scenarios, but it didn't seem to be as difficult for people in the same sex scenario to recognize what was happening and to set some boundaries. So that was just anecdotal evidence, but it was very interesting to watch these young men, particularly the You know, what I've noticed in my work, I've done a lot of work now in preventing sexual misconduct. It's one of the main themes of the courses we teach at the Shogaku Zen Institute. And one of the things I've noticed is early on, as I saw these young men or even older men who had not been in this position of teacher, had not had this experience yet. And some of what I noticed as I teach these classes and various communities have come to me with problems where their teacher has strayed and begun a relationship with a student, even when the student is either married or the teacher is that these teachers, prior to being in this position, understood the boundaries and were not swayed by them. There was something in their position of power that was a bit of an aphrodisiac for the students and blurred things for the teacher, and they weren't really prepared, even though they may have been, here comes my puppy, even though they may have been, come on up, you guys can meet my co-pilot here. He went out for a walk with his dad, but his dad is the second person. I am the primary. So there's something about being in a position of power and that projection that we have, whether it's daddy or some deity-like projection, that creates this kind of emotional charge that has built the problem that we have. And some people talk about the bad apples or the narcissists or psychopaths in the Buddhist community, but I don't think that's the problem. My understanding of it is more that it's a problem of what happens in a community when someone is in power and when the community is about protecting the teacher versus the members. So that's where the problem comes in. And it's almost like we designed our communities to promote this problem. We have a teacher in a singular position of power. We have the board of directors chosen who are mostly loyalists to the teacher. And there's kind of a distance between the teacher and the community. So when we're now teaching the skills that it takes both to be a spiritual teacher and a pastoral counselor, we talk about these issues of power, communication, and boundaries, and how important it is to understand this and to get help when you feel the pull of that tide pulling you into a relationship. So that's the main, and I don't think they have that. They have a little bit of that problem in Japan, which is why we didn't have training with it. But historically, in Japan, the geisha houses were positioned around the temples. So it wasn't that they had female students, they had the geisha to have a relationship or sex with. And so they didn't really have this to work on. And later, you know, as the temple priests became married temple priests, it became a very different dynamic and much more of a community togetherness versus the teacher being way up high and not having contact. I mean, we saw when we were in Japan at Rinzō-in, Suzuki Roshi's home temple, and the temple of Hoitsu Roshi, how much interaction there was when he was there at the temple doing things, drawing persimmons, etc., along with the community. Somebody looks like they might have a hand up. Heidi, is that a hand up?
Okay. I mean, you can finish your story about persimmons if you want to before I ask the question.
It's just wonderful to watch the fun they had together drawing the persimmons.
Well, it's interesting. I've had an experience that I, you speaking about this thing of power, right, that it's making me understand maybe something else. And this is like me going on left field a bit, like just as you're talking. But I live in Montreal, Canada, and we know that like the Catholic Church and the Christian Church, there's been a lot of like sexual abuse stuff and whatever. But let's like step away from that for a second. But my experience has been that if I go into a church or a Christian setting, I'm welcomed with open arms, no question asked, right? It's like, come in, if I don't kneel at the right time, if I don't whatever, it does not matter. Right? Stepping on the tatami crack is not a problem. Nobody judges how you, it's like, welcome, thank you, thank you. And all of the Buddhist centers that I've been to, Colorado, New York, Montreal, New Mexico, when you enter, you have to prove your privilege of being there. It's like, I enter this space and this quickly questions, how long have you been practicing? Do you know how to practice? Why are you here? Did you take the introduction class? Did you, you know, and then you have to kind of like resume out things really, really quickly to prove that you belong to be there.
Yeah.
Right. And this has happened again and again and again. And I had this experience just recently, and it was like really, somebody else explained to me that Zen lineage came from a military kind of aspect. And I just thought it was really fascinating that continues to happen. And I wonder if like part of it is in Christianity, the only person that chooses if you're worthy or not is God, right? Like it's God who says your relationship to God is the thing. But in Buddhism, a lot of the time, it's the teacher who says you're good enough to get this koan, you're good enough to be robed or whatever, as opposed to if I wanted to be a nun today, I could go to the church, like there's six around on my 6-block radius. I could walk in and I want to be a nun. And I'm telling you, like I would get top
Come on down.
Privilege to become a nun. Come on down. You want to be a nun? Let's go. Here's a bed. Like here, let's do it. Right. So I don't know. Like when you were talking, I was thinking about that. Like that it's just like.
Well, it is a big problem. And in fact, I wrote about it in my most recent book, Naked in the Zendo, because I talk about Suzuki Roshi in contrast to people in the Zen Center today. When I was, let's see, was I 21? I think so. And I was getting married. And we are getting married because we're leaving the country to go to Canada to escape the draft. And he was performing the ceremony. And I saw when I went for my rehearsal that he was wearing tabi. So I said, oh, I should wear tabi. What I didn't know was you only wear the tabi inside, not when you're walking across the street, bringing the dirt from the street into the zendo. So there I am on my wedding day with a skirt I made. I mean, full out hippie. I made the skirt that I was married in and my tabi. And Suzuki Roshi is standing at the top of the stairs watching me with the tabi, no sandal underneath it, walking across the street, walking up the stairs and dragging that schmutz into the zendo. And did he say anything? Not a word, not a word of correction, because, I mean, he probably did the calculation. Okay, this young lady is nervous enough. I'm not going to make her more nervous telling her she's doing something wrong. Okay. On the other hand, in terms of what you're saying, and I'm going to go into what I think is the source of it, When I gave a talk at San Francisco Zen Center, someone crossed the Buddha hall to move me 2 inches over to correct me. And I was the invited speaker. And, you know, it was obvious that this person knew that I should be 2 inches over, and I didn't know anything. So, what do I think causes that? I think it's because in the Zen centers, and I don't know about all of them that you were at, there's a residential community and there's a clique, almost a cult, which says, we know and you don't know. And it's the social psychology, the social dynamics, I think, that create that unwelcoming atmosphere. And when I did have a Zen center and a Zendo, I was very clear with my students, you're not to correct people. This is not a correction machine. That's not our job. Our job is to welcome people. But that message has not penetrated because there's kind of a feeling, and I had this feeling and was actually told many times, I'll give you another story, that the people who live in the Zen Center or who run the Zen Center, who are officers in the Zen Center, belong there, and you don't. You're an intrusion. You're a pain. So I remember one time I came, Hoitsu Roshi, who I spent a great deal of time with in Japan and knew personally, was at the Zen Center, and he was helping to perform a ceremony. So I came. And I heard a loud voice say, who invited Grace? And it's like, they, you know, this kind of in and out dynamic, I think, is something that people fall prey to when they are part of a community. Now, in the Christian community, I think there are specific values. I don't know that much about it, and I don't know that much about Catholicism because I'm Jewish, and I know women aren't very much welcomed in the Jewish community either. So I know that there's a value of recruiting and welcoming people, and generally the people who help organize and run the church do not live there. They're a community, and yes, they have their relationships. But the person who has that kind of authority to say you're in and you're out is the priest. So I think for me, it's about the social dynamics of what happens when people form a community. How are they taught values? Because we have it's my belief that we have, and I've read about this, we have tribal instincts of who belongs and who doesn't belong, because that's how we survived. Those of us who, if we believe in evolution, survived, came from tribes, because people who lived together in tribes protected each other. And so there's a certain tribal gene that's in and out, and they're outsiders and they're insiders. And we need to know about that in order to work on being more welcoming and not holding our knowledge as a barrier to other people's entry. Because I think it's instinctive that once people get together, they form a kind of tribe. Does that make sense? Yeah. So these are the kinds of things that we have taught about in Shogaku, particularly the social dynamics, because of there's a wonderful book called Loneliness, and describing the evolution of human beings in terms of being parts of tribes. The idea that you're not part of, if you do not belong, this is an existential threat, or it was historically, and maybe that's part of our genetic makeup, that belonging means survival. And this idea of loneliness as a hazard, not only to our survival, but actually now they can measure people who have that feeling of loneliness, who don't have a social group where they belong, are more stressed. Their immune system is more stressed. Their mental capacity is more stressed. So it's a threat to our health to not belong. And so it's a very strong pull to have this in-group and out-group. And this is something that we need to teach to people who are becoming Buddhist leaders. Because I think there's this very, and I certainly went through this phase, there's a very strong pull to feel that Buddhism either isn't a religion or is a religion that's way superior because it doesn't have these kind of cult-like feelings and beliefs. So we need to really work on that and understand that, yeah, this is a good system of helping yourself, belonging with people who have good values, and helping others. This is a very good system, but it's not perfect, and it needs to evolve to work well in our Western world. And we need to have respect for all the religions. Part of this comes from the fact that most of us who came into Buddhism came in from a different religion. So we think we chose Buddhism because it's superior. Anybody have other questions?
Grace, I have another question. You kind of touched on it earlier, talking about maybe emotions and awareness of emotions. And one thing I'm learning, you know, partway through my clinical pastoral education, I'm really starting to see, have more awareness about my emotions, seeing how I kind of interact in groups and how that has an effect. And even in things like body language, you know, as chaplains, we learn to sit at the bedside, to be kind of eye to eye with patients. And that's taken me a long time to really get in that habit. And I'm starting to sense that now more in just, you know, everyday interactions, how that physical proximity or distance or height, how all those things like really make a difference. And again, this is stuff that I think maybe is important to spiritual care. And it's kind of new for me. So yeah. I wonder how you see maybe that aspect. That kind
well,
of
I do see it as lacking in our training, in at least in my Zen training. And actually, I did some Tibetan training with a Dzogchen group, and they talk about emotions more and knowing emotions more than we do in Zen. And there's this idea in Zen that somehow we're going to go beyond emotions, or we're going to be able to transcend them and just somehow be a perfect being. But basically, because it isn't part of the curriculum of our Zen training, I almost always recommend that people also do therapy as a way of getting in touch with what's painful for them. Because what's painful sometimes is hidden from us. I remember, even as a therapist in training, my father died when I was 6. And if you ask me how that affected me, I would say, oh, not at all. I wasn't really in touch with those feelings. The first time I sat down with a patient whose father, a young woman, whose father had died, And she started talking about how much she missed her daddy and the ways she missed her daddy. I was a goner. And that was because it was an unexplored area for me. And even as a therapist, I hadn't covered that ground. So it's very important. And now, in this particular instance, it didn't separate us that I was being reactive to her emotions, but it can. Because if we're going to be present for other people's emotions, which is something that our meditation can help us with, then we need to have understand what traumas we are carrying. And so we don't get very much of that in our Zen. At least I didn't in my Zen training. It was like, if things arise, let them go. If it arises, let it go. Rather, and I would tell my students, okay, let it go during the meditation, but make a note. I'm going to get back to that and work on that with a therapist or in a group or something, because we don't really have that technology of working with emotions and ex allowing them, exploring them, processing them, and understanding when they're going to come up during our work with patients, because they can, especially from our Zen training, they can be about just push it away, just push it away as a solution versus really feeling that feeling and allowing it to arise so that it creates a connection to the other person versus a message, shut it down. And that's basically my experience was really in Zen training to let go, to shut down my feelings as they arose. It wasn't really possible. They didn't really go anywhere, but it does create a block between you and another person when you have material that's you haven't worked on. So it's very important, I think, that you're getting this training as part of your pastoral counseling training.
Yeah, thank you. And I think maybe in the insight tradition, they're a little better than in some of the contemporary Zen training in dealing with emotion and bringing awareness to that. One thing I noticed, we had a talker on grief a few months ago, and we had the highest number of attendees for one of these sessions. And I think it's because it's a topic that maybe even, well, I can't speak for Buddhism as a whole, but most of the Buddhist circles that I know of, maybe something like grief is a tricky topic because you mentioned, this tendency just to kind of let things pass through, and we don't want to attach to these feelings and having things arise and not be sticky. And so then grief sometimes becomes slightly awkward in that context of how to work with that, how to make space for that. And in pastoral care, that's a big, one of the biggest things that we're dealing with, this constant sense of loss of whatever it may be, health, identity, loved ones, relationships. So I'm wondering if that element of grief is something that's come up in the Shogaku training program.
I have to think about the courses we're offering. We do offer one course by Stephen Tierney, who taught at what was that? The Transpersonal Institute in San Francisco, and he taught the Buddhist approach to passing the master's license exam. So he taught about working with feelings. And that was where I think we've had the most success. But I think you bring up a big concern right now, because I think so-called post-COVID, we all have a lot of suffering stored up that we had to put aside while we were trying to figure out what we could do and how we could survive. And I noticed that for myself, there was a lot more depression and also some early memories connected to the depression of grief that I really hadn't dealt with yet. So I do think that not only do we not get the training in grief, but everybody would like to avoid it. It's not that much fun. And so how we give people permission to grieve and resonate with that grief is very important training. So I've talked a little bit about the Shogaku Zen Institute, and let me tell you about, we spoke about the formation of it, Lewis Richmond and I, in the arts of contemplative care. But for these reasons that I mentioned this morning, that our Zen training, and this was about both of us having been Zen students, our Zen training is disconnected in a certain way from our emotional life and even from our family life. Because when you think about Zen in other countries, particularly I know the training in Japan and I know the culture, having studied there a fair bit, children get the feeling of Buddhism sitting on granny's lap, being part of the family, celebrating and grieving during family rituals and holidays. That comes to them, and we're missing that. So what Jim has brought up is that what disconnects us from that whole experience of emotional life. If you start to experience Buddhism as a baby sitting on granny's lap and going through various holidays in the home, it's a very different experience than walking into a Zen center and being told not to step on the tatami cracks. So this is a big difference. And this is part of what we need to do to make up for the fact that we were raised probably either in another tradition or without religion, not clear, you know, not everybody has the same background. Now we come into Buddhism and there's a way that we put it on a higher level and do not connect to all of those personal and familial relationships that people who live and were born in a Buddhist culture experience. So this is important for us that's why I recommend it to all of my students that they seek therapy as a way of working with what was arising from the depth work they were doing in meditation and meditation retreats. So I think that this is a really important aspect of the training you're doing in pastoral care, is working on the feeling level. And in the Tibetan tradition, and of course in the insight tradition, there are many psychologists who became insight teachers. So I think that maybe explains why they work more on that level. But in the Tibetan traditions, the power of emotions is discussed, and the teaching that you receive is about feeling the power of those emotions and really knowing how powerful those emotions are versus, okay, that's a cloud passing in the sky of my zazen. So it's a very different approach, probably in both insight and Tibetan traditions. Any other thoughts or questions right now?
I had my hand raised, but I need to leave. I have another meeting at one. But I find it interesting that we're talking about emotions and grief side by side, because I think like we often approach grief attached to death. But there's grief around so many other things. And I think that's a good gateway to understanding grief is through these other emotions and these other things that often people are approached to grief work through the loss of a person. And anyways, in the work that I do, it's not that, you know, and so it's interesting to think of where that fits in. And even in our training now, like we've talked a lot about grief this last year, but it's really connected to hospital, people dying, you know, but there's a lot of other griefs that happen that, and there's joyful grief also, you know, that's kind of not mentioned.
Yes, and you're right. And one of the things is the kind of grief one experiences by being in contact with other people, vicarious traumatization and the grief that results there. For me, it's been very hard for me to be part of any Zen institution after I've worked with many, many women who have been damaged within the Zen tradition, either by a teacher or by sexism. So that vicarious traumatization and grief is so powerful that it has definitely affected how I can relate to Zen tradition and be part of a community anymore. Hardly at all. It's very powerful. And we experience it in working with other people. So I know you have to go. So you have your next meeting, Heidi. But I think this is a very interesting topic in that as we process our own feelings, we can become aware of how much grief we experience. I worked at a children's hospital in my training as a psychologist, and my experience of seeing what parents were going through made me want to go outside and kiss the sidewalk for the blessing that I had not to go through that. But I had a lot of suffering. And I remember talking to my Zen teacher about it. And he said, it's like you have to build up the ability to handle this suffering. You're right now overwhelmed with it. And you don't have the skills to process it. But that's part of our training. In working with other people is being able to experience the grief of others, to be affected by it, and to continue and not be destroyed by it.
Well, thank you so much, Grace. That was a wonderful talk, very, very inspiring, and yeah, great to hear all about your kind of journey through Zen and how it led you to this point. And thank you so much for being with us today. I just pasted a link to the ability to donate if anyone would like to support this speaker series. There's a link now in the chat you can follow if you'd be so inclined. And thank you to everyone for being with us today. We're going to meet next month. We have Alice Kabatahe speaking on May 18th about spiritual care is koan, formation and embodiment. So Alice is a teacher in the Rinzai Zen tradition. She's also the director of spiritual care at Stanford Health. And she's also a CPE educator. So she has a lot of experience, and she's a wonderful person. So she'll be joining us next month. So I'm going to ask this year's in-person, online, and eco-chaplaincy students to stay on the call, and we'll say goodbye to everybody else. Thank you.